Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez of Al Jazeera America, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Brussels terror attacks come against the backdrop of two crises in Europe, security and migration. The future of the Schengen area, the border-free zone, is at stake. German Chancellor Angela Merkel cut a deal for the EU with Turkey last week, aimed at ending, or at the very least managing, Europe's migration crisis. But that was before Brussels. Now terror threatens Merkel's open-door pitch. Meanwhile, thousands of migrants remain stranded at the EU border, fleeing the kind of terror that struck Brussels this week. This hour on Point, the Brussels terror attacks and the invigorated debate over migrants in the EU. You can join us on air or online. Is it possible to have secure internal free movement within the EU without better control of external borders? Should Europe stop the flow of migrants into the EU altogether? Join us anytime on onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Brussels is Ryan Heath. He's a senior correspondent at Politico Europe. He's been covering the latest developments out of Brussels. Ryan Heath, welcome back to On Point.
Good to be with you, Ray.
Well, since the smoke began to clear in the metro and the air terminal earlier this week, what have we found out? What's the big headlines out of the investigation?
A lot of terrible headlines, I have to say. Not a lot of hope, not a lot of good news. What seems to be clear is that the Belgian authorities are hamstrung by a chronic underinvestment in their capabilities, sometimes in their staffing numbers, and in their ability to share information. So all the crucial methods and instruments for actually tracking down the people who perpetuated the bombs and the attacks, the ones that still may be alive from Tuesday morning, and also the ability to shut down the remains of this terror cell or terror cells that we've heard so much about operating from that district of Molenbeek near the center of Brussels. So what we've had is a confusing series of raids and attempts to track down those people on the run, and not a lot of clarity about how far the Belgian authorities are from shutting down what could be attempts at future attacks, either in Belgium or abroad. And that's starting to have a range of very serious knock-on effects, including for all of those refugees in Greece and elsewhere trying to make their way onto countries such as Germany. Because countries around Europe are starting to put up the shutters and say, we don't want the refugees we said we were going to take. And then, of course, you have that huge deal looming in the background with Turkey, which many people say is illegal anyway in the first place. And now Turkey's pulling a new trump card in all of these discussions. They're saying they warned Belgium, the Netherlands, and some other countries about two of the people who are now suspected to have pulled off both the Paris and the Brussels attacks. So Turkey's saying, we did our bit. Belgium and other Western European countries, you're not doing yours. And that's really going to mess with that deal that was struck last week.
The two brothers, Ibrahim El-Bakroui and Khalid El-Bakroui, were in Turkey trying to get to the fight. And when they couldn't, they headed back to the Low Countries. This is an astounding and damaging revelation, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. And the Belgian authorities are correct in part of their response, which is that we got the information, we looked into them, we couldn't prove any link to terrorism. But the question that is left unanswered and the thing that is basically, as far as I can tell, deemed unacceptable by a very large majority of people is that the Belgians did at the local and the national level essentially just throw their hands up in the air and say, well, what can we do? And clearly what other countries have done, and you can call it draconian, but they have taken this measure. They've taken other steps to put in place very heavy monitoring of people suspected of being in danger or actually in the process of carrying out terrorist acts. And that's that very tricky gray area where you can't prove someone guilty if they haven't committed an act. but also are you being responsible if you don't do anything at all, really, to monitor them? And that's the situation the Belgians have found themselves in. They simply don't have the skills and the capabilities to track all of these people who are known to have gone to Syria to train, some of whom have gone on to commit these acts.
The shortcomings of the Belgian security apparatus seems to come as no shock, no surprise to other European leaders. At a joint press conference with French Prime Minister Manuel Valls yesterday, the President of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker, called for a security union and spoke about the need for closer collaboration to fight terrorism. This was interpreted by Euronews.
We also think we need to work together towards unified security. The Commission has proposed all the constituent elements for such a union of security. I'd ask the Council of Ministers not to yield to the mounting pressure of lobbyists and instead to keep in mind the essential, what must be done.
The French Prime Minister, Manuel Valls, called for systematic border controls in the Schengen area and deployment of bodyguards. He also renewed his calls for a passenger name record system to be set for air travel, also interpreted by Euronews.
I reiterated the urgent need to better fight arms trafficking, the need to adopt a European PNR system to enable the tracking of terrorists' movements.
Does this put Schengen under a very uncomfortable spotlight?
Yes, it does. I think the reality that people need to bear in mind is that the EU is very resilient. It has a lot of weak spots, it has flaws, and it's very slow to move in many crises because they haven't really figured out a governance system to get 28 kind of moving parts who often have very different attitudes to all move in the same direction coherently. So things look very messy from the outside. But the EU does have a track record of pulling things out and fixing things at the last minute. Unfortunately, when you get to something like a terror attack, it's not just money or dignity that's lost. It gets to the point of people's lives already being lost. So I think the EU still has some scope to pull this together, to save achievements like its Schengen zone, to develop things like a true security union. But you can't say that it's going to happen in an easy way. I think if Schengen survives, it's not going to look and feel like it has in the past. There's clearly going to be some kind of very heavy border guard that is put in place, and that is supported by the majority of people anytime they're asked in opinion polls. And there are going to have to be some level of targeted searches, restrictions, and other levels of security that simply weren't present in the past. And if leaders don't move in that direction, I think you then bring in this other difficult front, which is the rise of populist leaders in Europe. So some people may say that any move to adjust Schengen is pandering to those populist leaders, but it's a very real threat. You can legitimately say that populist lead countries such as Hungary and Poland now, clearly those who are more on the extreme right wing of things like Marine Le Pen are going to be in the running to be president of France next year. And you saw those right-wing groups obtain big successes in everything from German regional elections through to having this referendum in Britain about whether that country should stay in the EU or not. So there is a massive populist surge. And in the wake of events like the Brussels attacks, if there aren't efforts to reshape how Schengen operates, it's going to be in grave danger as a system.
Well, I find your confidence in the durability of these institutions very interesting, because there were already fissures, cracks starting to show before Brussels. For instance, Poland is heading for the exits, basically saying we're getting ready to shut our borders. We don't want any part of this more open Europe. There are splits east-west, northwest-southeast, and rich versus poor, aren't there?
Yes, there are. In the case of Poland and also in the case of Hungary, for example, the rhetoric is extreme and it's honestly felt. I don't think it's being misrepresented by the leaders. But what Poland and Hungary also want is the EU's money. They want the transfer payments that go from the rich countries of the EU into the pockets of their regional infrastructure funds, to the companies that build roads, to other things that are trying to bring those newer EU member states up to the level of the older, richer Western nations. sanctions. Now, if those money taps were to turn off, that changes the game of negotiations around refugees, around Schengen, and so on. And if the money were to simply stop being provided, then there would also be less incentive for those countries to ever compromise and play ball in that wider EU game. But I think where I have a quiet confidence about the EU being able to figure things out, it comes from, for example, the Greek and wider Eurozone crises that we saw from 2011 onwards. That looked terrible. It's been a disaster in many respects, both for the individual countries under the austerity policies and for the EU in an image sense. But what you do have now is a much stronger economic and monetary union set of rules, and Greece is still in the Eurozone. And many people were predicting throughout that four-year period that wouldn't happen, that the whole thing would fall apart. And so what I'm saying is when things look like they're falling apart in Europe, they don't always end up falling apart. But perhaps this is a new challenge of a new magnitude. And so maybe we are seeing the start of an unraveling here. But all I'm saying is that people need to look into the second and third layers of how the EU has knitted itself together, because it's more durable than it seems from the outside.
Ryan Heath of Politico Europe is with us from Brussels. We're getting feedback from our various social media channels. Fred Linskip writes on our website, "The size of the Syrian refugee problem in recent months can be tied directly to Putin's shoring up of the Assad regime and Assad's unwillingness to allow the possibility of himself stepping down as president of Syria to be part of negotiations with moderates." Charlotte, writing more specifically about Belgium on Facebook, notes, "If you watch the Belgian channel, RTL, you will see Belgians of all descents, all colors, all religions, together on the Place de la Bourse in Brussels showing solidarity. You will hear politicians speaking both French and Dutch in the same speech, putting differences aside. You will see people advocating for tolerance and unity." Lou writes on our Facebook page, "How do you filter a refugee from a crazed lunatic? You cannot, certainly not in the masses that are overwhelming Europe. Redirect these masses to Saudi Arabia and so on. Oh, that's right. They would be quick to stand in the way of an Islamist who might be from some other branch of Islam." And Sean writes, "This is only going to make both sides more radical. Europe is starting to shut its borders. I have a very bad feeling it will only get worse before it gets better." Ryan Heath will stay with us from Brussels. We'll be joined by Leonard Doyle of the International Organization for Migration and Mujtaba Rahman from the Eurasia Group after this break. I'm Ray Suarez in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the European migrant crisis against the backdrop of the terror attacks this week in Brussels. You can join the conversation, even if the terrorists who plotted the attacks in Belgium were homegrown, longtime legal residents or citizens of Belgium. Can we separate that attack from the wider context of a continent struggling to adapt to hundreds of thousands of new arrivals? Ryan Heath is still with me from Brussels via Skype. He's a senior correspondent at Politico Europe. Now joining us, Leonard Doyle, spokesman for the International Organization for Migration, and Mujtaba Rahman, principal Europe analyst for the Eurasia Group. And Mujtaba, in a situation like this, do governments, especially in democracies, face pressure to do something, even if it's a something that the experts say would eventually be ineffectual?
They do, and I think you're seeing that certainly in Europe's response to address this refugee crisis. Germany, Angela Merkel, Germany's leader, working hand in glove with the Turkish president to try and get a deal in place that's essentially going to restrict the refugee flow out of Turkey through the Aegean and into Greece. And in order to do that, the Europeans are pandering to the Turkish government, offering a whole host of concessions, from more money to offers of accelerated membership. Now, I think the big question we have to ask is the Turkish government going to do what the Europeans are asking for, which is essentially to act as Europe's border guard and introduce policies domestically in Turkey that improve the living conditions of Syrian refugees. That's really what the Europeans want the Turkish government to do. I think from our perspective, when we think about this government, when we think about Turkey over the medium term, we don't see large incentives for the Turkish government to comply. The leader, President Erdogan, is very much focused on reforming his constitution, centralizing more powers around his office. In order to do that, he has to hold a referendum at some point this or next year. That means he has to remain in something of a populist drive. Integrating Syrian refugees is not popular. That, I think, is on some level going to limit the government's willingness to do what Europe is asking. I think we also have to think about the Syria theater. The Turkish government, Erdogan, has a number of objectives in Syria. Those objectives are not being advanced, whether it's the establishment of a no-fly zone in northern Syria, whether it's putting pressure on the Americans to stop funding the PYD, the Kurds in Syria, whether it's the imminent removal of the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad. The international community writ large does not support those objectives. Until they do, I think the Turkish government is going to continue using refugees as leverage to try and get the Europeans and the international community on board with its objectives in Syria. So we do have an agreement between the Europeans and the Turkish government to get this crisis under control. But given what I've said about Turkey, I just don't think it's going to last beyond the next few months.
Leonard Doyle, if you're a kid on a fishing boat or a dinghy about to land on a Greek island, was your near-term future just decidedly altered by a bunch of guys with luggage carts in an airport more than 1,000 miles away?
Well, I think the change has been coming for some time. I mean, remember we had the Bataclan attacks in November. So the policies that we've seen put in place in Europe didn't just get cooked up overnight. And I just need to take issue quickly with the previous speaker, because the idea that Turkey is not welcoming to Syrian refugees is just wide of the mark. There's 2.7 million Syrian refugees currently in Turkey. So I think we need to just not broad brush paint countries in this way. It's just not right. What's happening in Europe is a gradual realization that if they don't sort out their house and manage the migration flows in and out of the continent, it's going to wreak havoc politically, as Ryan said earlier. And that's what's happening. You've had a move to the extreme right in German elections over the last couple of weeks, and you have it right across the continent. And I think there's a recognition that by the political leadership in Europe, the 28 of them, that they've got to sort it out and they've got to stop disagreeing and start agreeing. And that's what they've done. I mean, the transfers of funds to Turkey are important. In fact, what it's doing is it's making Turkey part of the solution rather than part of the problem. How it works out in practice, we'll see. But you can see there's an extraordinary determination for the European project to continue. And I think the news of its demise, a little bit like Mark Twain, have been kind of called out far too many times for us to take it too seriously anymore.
Leonard Doyle is with us from Geneva. Mujtara Rahman is in London. Ryan Heath is in Brussels. And Brian is calling from Montreal, Canada. Brian, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray. I'm really glad to toss just a few pennies into this coin of information that you're putting out. I live in the Arab quarter of Montreal. We have a lot of North Africans who've come to Quebec because the chances of making a living here are way better than in France or North Africa. And I want to just toss in that the French traditions of policing, they look back at Europe as the place to copy, and they do not renew and change the constitution, the number of people they recruit to police our areas corresponding to the people they're serving. That has terrible consequences. As I say, I live in an area which is the highest density of Arab speakers in my city. Not a single cop on the beat speaks Arabic, and that goes for our whole province. This can only be disastrous in Europe, and I have a feeling it is the same tradition. You get hired for life into one of these public services in the French tradition, and that means the way that these organizations work changes glacially slowly. And in this case, they need to move fast. I don't see they're capable of it, and they're certainly not going to learn to speak Arab and learn to live the way the Arabic communities live.
Ryan Heath, when we saw those blocks thrown up around a neighborhood in Brussels around the arrests of Abdeslam Were those officers likely to be only Flemish or French speakers, not an Arabic speaker in the bunch, as our caller suggests?
Yes, absolutely. And that's been worrying me more and more in recent days. So up until 2016, and I stress that I can't speak for the last few months, I imagine that they are trying very hard to recruit or to teach Arabic language skills in these last few weeks since Paris. But up until the end of last year, there were only two Arabic-speaking police officers for the district that covers Molenbeek. Now, considering that's an area that is nearly majority Muslim and where certainly more than half of the people do speak Arabic at some level, to have only two officers that can actually communicate with that community is verging on the levels of dissonance that you see in American policing between white and African-American sort of policing and police situations. And obviously, it also means in the case of tracking terror suspects in a community where there are known to be at least 95 people living there who have trained in Syria and are radicalized to the extent that the Turkish government was worried enough to warn the Belgians about it. How do you actually even track what those people are doing, let alone stop them from doing it, if you don't know what they're saying or who they're saying it to? So it's clearly a fundamental logistical disaster, as well as something that doesn't really help community harmony. And I think that that is the sort of thing that, I mean, you don't turn on a podcast and learn Arabic overnight. It's something that takes a long time to fix, and it's going to have to be tackled in a much more serious way, or we're going to see an unraveling of that community and potentially further violent acts as we have this week.
Mujtaba Rahman, is the story likely to be very much the same with the Metropolitan Police in London?
I mean, I really can't speak to that issue, Ray, but if I could very quickly come back to Lennard's comments on Turkey, because I do think this is an important part of the EU-Turkey agreement and the broader refugee crisis. I think that, you know, there is a very strong sense that the living conditions in Turkey are simply not hospitable for Syrian refugees. I stand by and reiterate that point. I mean, the Turkish government is not a signatory to the Geneva Convention, and despite a fair amount of pressure from European leaders and officials working in the various European institutions, the Turkish government has proven totally unwilling to come forward with an action plan to integrate Syrian refugees. I mean, there are very big concerns about the legality of the deal struck last week, precisely because Turkey has not been designated as a safe third country, despite the fact Greece is likely to make moves in that direction this week. So the idea that Turkey is somehow part of the solution, I think, is a total misinterpretation of the actual problem. In terms of what the government is after, sure, I don't think money hurts, but I think what the government really wants is visa liberalization, and it's visa liberalization that is going to be the most difficult for European heads of state to deliver, especially in the aftermath of the Belgian attacks, given the concern, certainly in Central and Eastern Europe, that visa liberalization for 80 million Turkish nationals will on some level represent a security threat for the rest of the EU. So,
Mujtaba, I want to get a response from Leonard Doyle. Quick response, Leonard.
Well, it's just not the Turkey I know and have come to appreciate enormously. The idea that 70 million Turks are a threat to Europe is, again, patent nonsense. It's like saying 10 years ago that the Spanish were a threat to Europe or the Portuguese were. I mean, we Irish had the same thing. We're in a different place now. We're in a new country, and it's not the country of 10 or 15 years ago. And we need to focus on the realities of modern Turkey, which is a tremendously exciting dynamo of economic growth, with its issues, of course, but who wouldn't have issues living up against the civil war of Syria and living in that neighborhood? So, I mean, there are problems. I'm not going to deny it. I'm not going to pretend it's a perfect place. But Turkey is certainly being drawn into the solution. That is absolutely clear, because without Turkey, you're going to have landings of refugees and migrants on the shores of Greece, people drowning. As of the last couple of days, you have 200 registered, so the tiny numbers now in comparison to what they were. And one assumes that that's coming because of the degree of collaboration and cooperation taking place that wasn't there before. So, I mean, to have them collaborating is obviously going to save lives, and that's clearly important. But to go back to one of your earlier points about the policing, I mean, it's obviously the case also that intelligence sharing and policing are like the last bastions of sovereignty. These European countries don't want to share it. Just as European people are having difficulty in having foreigners come and live among them, because sovereignty is still a tough issue here. You may have free trade, you may have free movement of goods, but it's difficult to get free movement of people without getting the opportunist politicians involved and creating havoc.
Let's go back to the phones. Devin is with us now from Tampa, Florida. Devin, you're on Point.
Hi, Ray. My point is I think we should close the borders, Europe, our borders, to this type of refugee, this type of flow, to illegal immigration, to go back to what the core of our country and those countries were, is to only allow people that truly want to become citizens of that country to come in. That's part of the problem. My grandmother came over from Italy on a boat to become an American, and she would get upset at people in her community who spoke Italian and say, speak English, we're Americans now, we're not Italian. And that's the difference, is integration into the community because they want to become citizens of that country. And I think that's a root of the problem.
But Devin, let me ask you a question. In this context, is a refugee, someone who's fleeing barrel bombs, the pulverization of their towns, different from an immigrant, someone who plans, desires to move to another country and become part of that country?
Absolutely, and that's why we should close the borders and not let that person in. Go, if we want to help them in their country to stop that, because they're never going to really become part of the community of the country that they're going to. It's just going to cause these kind of problems. And there's no way we can filter those people and know who is truly wanting to be there out of fear or who is bringing fear to the country. So it's insanity to think that we can could ever filter that properly.
Let me get quick response to Devin from Tampa, Florida. Thanks for your call. First, Ryan Heath, is this a growing sentiment in Europe, even with the well-known sufferings of the people who are trying to come out of Western Iraq and Syria, justifying somewhere else where they won't be in such danger?
Yes, I would say it is, and I actually have a quite personal example to share there, where one refugee from Syria who I interviewed about 6 weeks ago as part of a story looking at what organizations outside of government are doing or can do to support refugees to integrate into society and to effectively be part of a working policy rather than a disastrous policy. He was a man called Mike, a 29-year-old Christian Syrian who had fled because he was about to be conscripted into Assad's army, and he had to leave behind his wife and his unborn child. So his child is now born, but he's never met her, and he's made it to Belgium and finally been received as a refugee, and now is trying to get his family to reunite with him. And he finally got into permanent accommodation away from those sort of very dreary detention centers or camps where he was living when he first arrived. And within 2 hours of the bombs going off on Tuesday morning, he had a note from two of his neighbors downstairs that demanded to know why he wasn't back in Syria fighting ISIS, why his wife wore a veil, and in fact she doesn't wear a veil, and essentially halfway between accusing him of being one of the bad guys or being a bad person for not staying in a war zone to fight the bad guys. And it wasn't a direct threat, but it struck me that the only refugee that I have direct contact with in Belgium had that reaction thrust upon him 2 hours after the attacks. And so it's a microcosm, but it says to me that that must be happening on a larger scale across Europe.
Leonard Doyle?
Look, I think you need to get out more, Ryan, to be honest. The Tent Foundation surveyed 12,000 people in 11 countries between 2015 and early 2016. Despite the bombings in Paris, you find people still supporting the refugee policies. So, anecdotal reporting is wonderful for journalism, and I've been a journalist for many, many years, but we have to deal in facts. We have to deal in, like, what people are telling surveys, scientific surveys, and they're basically
saying...
So
why aren't the leaders doing more, then, if the people want this to be supported?
There's no question there's a dissonance between what they're learning from the yellow side of the journalistic spectrum and from the extremist politicians, and it's driving voters to that position. It's driving politicians to that position. But the core middle ground of public opinion is what I'm talking about, is supporting refugees. You have 71% of people in January 2016, that's 12,000 people, saying yes, they would be willing for their country to take some refugees. Of course, you've got the various countries acting, you know, in extreme ways. But let's look at the positive side of the story, which is that the center is holding.
And there's no softening of those numbers after Bataclan, for instance.
There's been a slight softening. I mean, the same question, in you know, they were down to 52 to 47% in January 2016, which is after Bataclan. So that's down from 55 to 45%. So just a slight softening of it. So let's at least have these arguments based on the numbers, and not our numbers. They're coming from the Tent Foundation.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simplest way to create a beautiful website. Whether your passion is bold, unconventional, or just plain crazy, you should share it with the world in an unforgettable way. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint. And enter offer code ONPOINT at checkout to get 10% off your first purchase.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the border security and migrant crisis in the EU. You can join the conversation. Should Europe be less welcoming to refugees fleeing the Middle East and North Africa? Is there a way to enforce border security without alienating newcomers, without alienating Muslim communities? My guests are Ryan Heath, senior correspondent for Politico Europe, Leonard Doyle, spokesman for the International Organization for Migration, and Mujtaba Rahman, principal Europe analyst for the Eurasia Group. Poland's prime minister, Beata Szydło, told a Polish TV station Wednesday that after the attacks in Brussels, Poland should not accept any more migrants. Here she is, interpreted by Ukraine Today.
For me, it is obvious at this moment there is no possibility for migrants to come to Poland. We need to firstly think about the security of Polish citizens. The previous government declared it will participate in accepting refugees, but I do not see a possibility for migrants to come to Poland at the moment.
Beata Szydło, of course, leading a fairly new Polish political dispensation after a turn to the right in their most recent elections. Context, timing, gentlemen, are very important. Mujtaba Rahman, going across to the other side of the continent, is the Brexit, the so-called British exit from the European Union, something that could be pushed or pulled by crises of this kind?
I mean, I think absolutely. It's not our central scenario. We ultimately do believe the British public is going to vote to remain a member of the EU. But I think it's important to remember that David Cameron, British Prime Minister, has focused on security, and he is making a very big argument that being a member of the EU is beneficial for the UK from a security perspective. And I think that narrative, of course, becomes harder to sell in a context where there is a growing perception in the UK that the European leadership is failing on the question of borders, migration, terrorism. It does reinforce that skepticism here in the UK. So I do think it's an unhelpful factor. And, you know, we know from our discussions with folks in Downing Street that the context at the time of the vote is something that is very, very concerning for government officials and certainly for Cameron and his team. I think that could potentially prove to be the decisive factor above and beyond, you know, the economics of the UK's relationship with the EU or the recent package of reforms David Cameron negotiated with Europe, which I think are widely perceived to be weak. I think it's context at the time of the vote takes place that will ultimately prove deterministic for which way people vote. So I think absolutely, yes, it is very important.
Britain finds the Europol organization not strong enough, isn't that right? I mean, they want to be part of a much more rigorous security effort, the so-called Five Eyes.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, as I've said, I think there is a strong sense that the European leadership is failing. Of course, we had the Greek debt crisis over the course of the last few years, and I think the UK looks at that and, you know, I think that the conclusion is it was a good decision for the UK not to participate in the single currency. We obviously have an opt-out regarding Schengen. We're very defensive, let's say, about our own security and intelligence arrangements. And I think, you know, the Five Eyes arrangement speaks to that. But I think, you know, there's a broader question, and Ryan alluded to this in his opening remarks about Europe's structural capacity to deal with these problems. Ultimately, I also subscribe to this view that Europe has proven resilient and is likely to prove resilient, but the amount of time and energy it takes to ultimately arrive at a collective solution means there's a lot of muddle through in the middle, and in that period, a lot can get worse before it indeed gets better.
Let's go back to the phones. Chris is calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. I believe that we're looking at the wrong end of the problem. We're looking at the back end. Move people, stop people, manage people. We should be talking about what we're doing about the weapons. You know, let's manage the weapons. Are European taxes going to the arms for the Middle East? And what about my taxes? I just think that if we took care of the front end of the problem, we wouldn't have all of this back end of the problem.
Ryan Heath, you'll hear that a lot, that because we're not taking care of the underlying illness, that is, the wars that are ravaging the Eastern Mediterranean right now, we can't address the knock-on causes that come from that war without looking at the war itself.
There's an element of truth in that, certainly, and there's another underlying long-term issue that I think is certainly not being addressed adequately in Belgium, and that is the more educational and grassroots strategy of how do you build communities and an overall society where everybody feels that they have a chance and an opportunity to exploit their potential and live their values. And that is something that is not happening enough in a district like Molenbeek or in other places across Brussels and Belgium. And I think that is not a sexy response in this very heated debate or a time of a manhunt in the aftermath of a bombing. But what it does say is that if you're not willing to work over a 5, 10 and 20 year time frame, then you're not going to root out those root causes of people's alienation. And I think to go back to the original question around the wars, then yes, I'm not saying that an intervention is the solution, but if you're not willing to go all in to accept that there are huge migratory flows coming from those wars, and by the way, there will be many more millions coming from North Africa and at times sub-Saharan Africa over the coming years into Europe, then you're not dealing with the problem. Simply coming up with one deal with Turkey or building one wall in Hungary or if you're the Polish government turning your back on your previous commitments, that's not going to change the fact of those other millions that are coming. And it doesn't change the relativity around the fact that Turkey, Jordan and Lebanon host millions upon millions of people fleeing this conflict. And Europe ultimately isn't hosting that many. And by the way, the United States has accepted barely 3,000 Syrians since 2011. So it is very easy from a distance in the US or Canada to say that the EU is not handling this well. But I think collectively the West has failed to come up with a solution either to the conflict or to participate on equal terms with these other host countries.
Alonzo joins us now from Buffalo, New York. Alonzo, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. Very stimulating today. And I had some comments, and as I listened to each individual, they continue to shift. And my mind went to a song lyric. What a sad, sad situation. It's just getting more and more absurd. We're at the height of technology. We're at the height of human knowledge. And what are we doing? Fighting, killing, terrorizing. I was born when Dr. King, Robert Kennedy, Anwar Sadat, Golda Meir, and John F. Kennedy were trying to pursue peace. There was a sense of fearness and realness. I wake up every day. People have gone crazy. But under these situations, we have to make some hard decisions. You can't just let a running saint just run and run and run. It causes damages nobody even considered. I want people to be safe. My heart bleeds for immigrants fleeing terror and destruction by their own rulers. When the body is under attack, it creates things that try to fight the toxins in what it's under attack. I don't know what the answer is, but I believe in Europe, the people who are already safe, they need to feel safe. I'm an American. I need to feel safe. Think about it. I get afraid. Why should I have to be afraid? Our governing bodies have to come up with some big answers. And I did appreciate what the guy said from Tampa. If you want to be an immigrant and go to a country, realize you have to make a decision. You have to become that country. You want to immigrate to France, you must become a Frenchman. You immigrate to the United States, you must embrace us. We have people now trying to colonize the countries they move to, and unfortunately the good comes with the bad and bad comes with the good. So we have people with these blood feuds, they bring it where they go. And believe it or not, the Islamic State is alive, and its platform is it wants to rule the world by any means necessary. In any little way, we have to see what we can do. So it's a big, big picture. And somebody's always going to be offended. But I'm living in a free country, and I cherish my freedom, and I don't want it to be a bridge just because somebody else is having a problem. So it's a huge problem. I don't have the answer, but the ruler's going to have to come up. Something's going to have to be sacrificed on both sides. But maybe the side with the bigger problem is going to have to make the bigger sacrifice.
Alonzo, it sounds like you and I are generational peers, and it's interesting that of the four leaders that you named, Dr. King, Bobby Kennedy, Golda Meir, and John Kennedy, only one of them got to die in bed of old age, and that was Golda Meir. The others were murdered by assassins. The world has been a complicated and sometimes horrifying place over our lifetimes, and there hasn't always been a peaceful road to the kind of changes that those assassinated leaders speculated on. I think a lot of people, a lot more people, as we debate this in the United States, are trying to figure out where they stand on just what they want from people who come to this country to make their lives here. And I think they're looking with a little bit of nervousness and dismay over at what's going on in Europe. But the situations, despite what you hear in the ongoing presidential campaigns, are pretty different in Europe from here. And as was noted just a moment ago, we've only taken just a relative handful of refugees from the conflict in Syria and Iraq in this country. And even with that being the case, one of our leading presidential candidates has, speculated about the patrolling of Muslim neighborhoods in the United States. Let's go back to the phones. Omar is calling from Niagara Falls, New York. Omar?
Hi, Ray. I just wanted to say that I wish the media would portray things as they really are and as they really know them to be.
That's what we try to do every day, Omar. You're saying we don't?
Well, unfortunately, not everybody does all the time. So the point I want to make is ISIS does not represent Muslims. ISIS has nothing to do with Islam, nothing whatsoever. ISIS is a political organization that has decided, amongst many other political organizations in the Middle East, to raise the flag of Islam because it can help rally people around it. No more, no less. It is a political organization that seeks power and money, no more and no less. So does Al-Qaeda, so does Jabhat al-Nusra, all of them. They are political organizations, and I wish the media would stop portraying them as organizations that represent Islam, because they do not. We didn't vote for them. There's billions of Muslims around the world that did not vote for them, do not want them, and want to see them disappear. But they're not going to disappear. And here's the thing. They're not going to disappear until the Western world realizes the only way to defeat them is by giving people in that part of the world a reason to live as opposed to a reason to die. For as long as these people have no reason to live, well, guess what? They're going to turn to organizations like ISIS.
Mujtaba Rahman, what do you have to say to Omar?
I mean, I think it's interesting when we should focus on what the Europeans and the Americans are doing to combat ISIS in Syria. I mean, there is a question. What is Europe? What is Europe's response to the current issues and problems in Syria and with ISIS specifically? I think, you know, 3 to 4 months ago, it was very clear the perspective in Europe was to use Russia's intervention as a vehicle to both attack the Islamic State using Russia's military resources, as well as to use the Russian government's proximity to the Assad regime to get better intelligence and make the military campaign more effective. I think there's also a belief that Russia had a role to play diplomatically, given its proximity to the Assad regime. Of course, facts on the ground demonstrated Russia had very different objectives. Number one, to obviously shore up Assad, but also not really in its military intervention targeting the Islamic State, but actually taking out folks that the Americans believe ultimately deserve to be part of a political transition in Syria. We have no real policy on the Islamic State. I think since Russia has surprisingly pulled out of Syria, Europe has no policy response at the moment, as far as I understand, in Syria to deal not only with the political transition and the questions around the government that, that is currently still in power or has certainly, its power has been reinforced, but certainly also against the Islamic State. So this problem isn't going to go away. If anything, it over time looks as though it could indeed get worse. And again, with pressure from Syria into Turkey, with questions around living conditions in Turkey and what the government is and is not willing to do to integrate Syrian refugees, you're going to continue to see this blowback, into Europe in a context where I think there is more internal division and less coherence among European leaders. The Polish example you alluded to speaks to that, I think, in a very real way.
Leonard Doyle, if you just freeze the game and all the players stop where they are, that really hurts the people who are struggling to get out of Syria, doesn't it?
It does, and one, of course, hopes that the peace talks, the peace endeavors, you know, kind of yield some fruit. And we have to remember, you know, that these people are refugees from terrorism, and they're not bringing terrorism with them. There's been some talk in this conversation which would imply that the migrants and refugees are the problem. There is no evidence whatsoever that any migrant or refugee has ever lifted a finger in any terrorist act in this last context. So I think, you know, we have to remember that these are the guys who are fleeing terrorism. And just to the broader point, if there is no economic opportunity for people who come as immigrants, migrants, refugees, what is to happen to their children except alienation? And, you know, in a sense, if Europe has a problem, it has to look itself in the mirror and say, like, what is it that we've not done to these societies, these communities, so that they feel that they're part of our nation built, our nation. It speaks to some of the points of your callers, that why is there not a stronger sense of unity? Why is a terrorist on the run, sheltered by a community for so long?
Probably that's Leonard Doyle, spokesman for the Director General of the International Organization for Migration. Thanks for joining us, Leonard.
Pleasure.
Mujtaba Rahman leads Europe's analysis at the Eurasia Group. Terrific to have you with us.
Thank you, Ray.
And Ryan Heath joined us from the very beginning, senior correspondent for Politico Europe. He joined us from Brussels. Ryan, thanks a lot.
A pleasure as always.
Continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, ISIS strikes, Brussels leaving Europe on edge, Obama in Cuba, Trump cruise heats up, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.